Hey guys, welcome to episode 230 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope you're doing well and that you're ready for another episode. As always, we kind of haven't done this in a while, but say thank you to everyone who comments or rates the podcast. It really means a lot to us and it really helps us kind of get the news out there about the podcast. So we appreciate it. And we also appreciate everyone who has been so kind. On Instagram, I made a post about how we hit 10 million downloads.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. It's not too shabby for, you know, a bi-weekly podcast, you know?
Yeah, because we only release two episodes every month, but we release four episodes technically every month. And if you're a member of Patreon, you could have four episodes instead of two. Just a little subtle plug there.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. Yes, absolutely.
And also ad-free episodes, so people always tend to like that, too.
They do. I also wanted to just say right off the top, too, I almost want to, like, build in a segment of, like, just briefly saying what the funniest comment that I saw for the week was.
Oh, God.
There was a comment that I was dying
laughing.
Where
was it on?
Oh, my gosh. You know me, I look at all the comments, so I'm losing.
It might have been John's a comment troll.
I am. I think it was Patreon, and it was hilarious. The person, I don't know, they were very nice. But let me just first start off by saying that. They were just saying how, love the episode. You guys did a great job. And then, like, at the end somewhere, it was just like, but I don't know what's going on. I keep hearing the same thing about Jeffrey Dahmer. I keep hearing the words every time. Oh. And I was dying laughing. And because somebody then responded, that's their intro. And it just caught me so off guard, but it was hilarious. Out to you guys because that was good.
Well, we have that intro from 2017. So yeah. We haven't changed our intro once. I mean, if you guys want us to change it, let us know. But I always thought it was back in the day in 2017, every podcast had an intro like that. Like that was the format of the show where there would be an opener, the intro, and then you'd start the case. But I think people have changed their formatting because a lot of people are filming their podcasts.
Yeah.
I think the intro has died out, but I mean, I guess I'm a creature of habit. I always just plug it in.
Hey, listen, we could put it up to a poll and just, have you guys, let us know what you want. I mean, that's fine.
Is our intro played out? You guys are tired.
Is our intro corny now? Is it just not, up to the current standards? But yes, please let us know. But I just, like I said, and by the way, this is not me being passive aggressive and throwing shade. I thought your comments were genuinely funny, and it just made me feel a certain way in the moment. So yeah. Just wanted to throw that out there.
And another thing I just want to add before we get started into the podcast is that if you're new to Patreon, please stay tuned at the end of the episode because we'll be giving you a personal shout out. And if you want ad-free episodes and two extra bonus episodes a month, you can join us at patreon.com/truecrimecouple. Okay, John, now that your segment's done, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
After a late-night church service, Dania DaCosta began the familiar half-an-hour ride home. She had done the drive so many times, she could have done it with her eyes closed. But as she cruised down I-95, she felt her car sputter, then slow. She had run out of gas. As she eased onto the shoulder, she may have thought of her mother. The lessons drilled in long before moments like this ever came. Be prepared, stay alert, know what to do. So Dania followed those rules. Windows up, doors locked, hazards flashing. From where she stood, she could see the glow of the Texaco sign just off the exit ramp. Not far at all. As she clutched the empty gas can, she stepped into the night, convinced that it would be a quick walk. She'd make it.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
In 1998, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, was a city in transition. For decades, it had been known as the spring break capital of the United States. However, city officials had worked hard to crack down on the party reputation and establish the area as a laid-back, sun-soaked coastal city, that would attract year-round residents rather than rowdy guests. And that it did. But those that came to the area were very different. As the 20th century came to a close, the dichotomy of this city became more and more apparent between those that lived in the affordable, more inland area, where crime remained above the national average, despite the fact that the town had shed its sinful skin, and those who lived in the safe waterfront properties on the canal, an area that came to be known as the Venice of America. Within the inland communities, there existed large immigrant populations, specifically, as was common in Broward County in the late 1990s, Caribbean immigrants. The largest of that group were those from Jamaica, and among those who had moved to South Florida was Daphne Lewis Bowe. She had come to America in the 1980s with her 5 children, in hopes of giving them a life and opportunities they otherwise would not have had access to if she had stayed in Jamaica. Daphne worked tirelessly to provide a stable home and good life for her children. But in her eyes, there was to be a balance. Since she upheld her end of the bargain, she expected nothing less than constant hard work from all of her children. They could do what they wanted, but they just had to strive to be the best at it. Daphne instilled in her children the same mindset she had. America was the land of opportunity, but you had to work for it. And through that message, she raised children with determination, grit, and a strong work ethic. But just as there was to Daphne, there also existed a kind and loving side to the children as well. And that they got from their mother. One of those children, in 1998, was 21-year-old Dania DaCosta. Dania was very intelligent, and according to her mother, she had the ability to pursue medical school. However, she was very adamant about wanting to make a difference and going where she believed she could provide the most help to her patients and their families. So she chose instead to become a pediatric nurse. In early December of 1998, she was working towards that goal by attending classes at the local community college. In order to pay for her schooling, her bills, the future loan she would need to take out to finish her degree, Dania worked 3 jobs in alternating shifts, so she would still be able to attend school.
I mean, that's pretty crazy. I mean, I don't even know many people that would even work one.
Yes.
I feel like the only person I know that was in college and worked a job, well, was you when I met you. You know?
Yeah, I worked at the daycare center.
Because I just know so many people that I, you know, I mean, because I didn't go to college, but I knew a lot of people that were at the time. And yeah, none of them went to work.
I never had the option. I mean, it was nice to pay the interest off of student loans because I was very stupid and I chose to, I had an academic scholarship to go to school, but then I wanted to live there. So then I had to pay for that. But I mean, it was the whole experience, so I don't regret it. But it was nice to pay the interest off while you were in school and then be able to afford groceries and stuff.
Yeah, well, you need a little bit of play money, you know what I mean? You do. But anyway, getting back to Dania, 3 jobs is insane. It's insanity.
It's incredible, and it just shows her work ethic, kind of like what I alluded to of her mom, like, really prepping her for, you know, if you work hard, you can get all of the things that you dream of. And, oh, and fun fact, just sometimes people like when we throw in some stuff about us. The daycare that I worked at all through high school and college is where Ryan goes now.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
So life comes full circle sometimes. Full
circle.
Yes. So now, if you thought that there was no way that Dania could have possibly fit anything else on her plate, you would be wrong. No matter how busy or hectic her schedule became, Dania never let it get in the way of the thing that she held almost as dear to her as her family, her faith. Dania, just like the other members of her family, was a congregant at the large and lively Faith Tabernacle Church, a Pentecostal church. If Dania was not at work or school, she could be found at church. There, she volunteered her time to teach Sunday school, sing in the choir, and attend midweek and weekend services, and she did that multiple times per week.
I mean, she has a very busy schedule.
Yes, she's got some energy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to be 21 again.
I know, right?
Daphne had instilled in her children religion just as much as she had hard work. But the Pentecostal faith held a special spot in Donya and her sister Rochelle's heart, and the two sisters often attended services together. The church also offered the hardworking immigrant family connections within the community that allowed them to feel accepted, at home, and provide opportunities, whether it be work or school related, through other members of the church. And that's something that has existed since urbanization in America. So, I mean, that's always been true to the heart of an immigrant community is their religious practices. And that's what we're seeing here with the church that Donya attends. Because Donya was so willing to help out and give back and was just such a kind-hearted person, she had earned herself many friends and the reputation of an angel in everyone's eyes. And it was to church that Donya was headed on the night of Friday, December 4th, 1998. Many other 21-year-olds would have been getting ready to hit the bar or club scenes of South Florida, but not sweet Donya. She was gearing up for the midnight church service. But on that night, things broke from their routine, so solidly established by the sisters Donya and Rochelle. Rochelle had a shift change at work, so she wouldn't be able to make the service, so Donya would have to attend alone. Now, she knew a lot of people within the community of Faith Tabernacle, so the problem wasn't going alone, but rather driving alone. But Donya, not wanting to make anyone feel bad, assured her sister and mother that she would be totally fine because she didn't want to miss the service. Daphne had asked her daughter to call her when she left the service after it had wrapped up so that she would know to wait up for her when Donya was going to come home. And Donya assured her that she would. Daphne never seemed to rest easy if one of her children were out, but she felt a little bit safe because she and her family knew about just every member of the congregation, and they always looked out for each other. And she knew that Donya had a good sense about her because she had taught it to her. But still, the problem wasn't the church group per se, but the area that surrounded it. Broward County is a part of the Miami metropolitan area, which meant the county sheriff would have to deal with higher crime rates as metropolitan areas are known to attract the criminal element. So she was worried about Donya being out so late by herself. True to her word, as always, she called her mother when the service ended. Donya assured her that she would be headed home, but that she shouldn't wait up. Daphne knew the ride home from the church to their home in Deerfield Beach would only take about half an hour. However, she also knew that Donya liked to stick back and socialize and speak to the pastor after service. Most of the time, her daughter was the last person to leave. So she headed to bed. We do know that the church service that night got out around midnight, changing the date to December 5th, 1998. Donya was one of the last people to leave the church, as was assumed by her mother. Because of this, the pastor walked her to her vehicle to ensure that she got there safely, because it was so late. He saw Donya get into her car and drive away. From there, he assumed her to be safe, so he left and went home as well. In order for Donya to get home, she would have to get onto I-95 northbound at the Broward Boulevard exit, which is exit 27, and travel northbound to exit 42, which was the Hillsborough Beach Boulevard exit. The amount of time that she would have had to have stayed on I-95 was approximately 15 miles, or around 24 kilometers. From her exit, she would basically be home, but she would never make it. The 21-year-old ran out of gas just before the Hillsborough Beach exit on I-95. Running out of gas on the busiest commercial interstate in the United States is never a good thing. It's dangerous, and vehicles, especially with high traffic from 18-wheelers, are always going by at fast speeds. The situation for Danya was made especially worse based on the fact that it was very late at night / early in the morning. Luckily, she had been able to pull over to the shoulder and avoided any collisions. And even luckier, she was so close to her exit. She must have been upset about the mistake. Often extremely busy, running between multiple jobs, school, home, church, it was common for her to run out of gas frequently and not refill it until completely necessary. And remember, guys, this is way before our cars digitally told us how many miles we had left. So you kind of had to just trust your gauge.
This sounds like somebody that I know that trusts that gauge a little too much. Who am I referring to?
I'll go down to like 2 miles. It's a little different in New Jersey.
Is it?
It's a whole thing. You got to be like in the mood to go get gas because someone else does it for you. Sometimes they take too long. It's like a requirement to be a creepy gas station attendant in New Jersey. Like no one's normal. So it's like you can't just go in and out and get it. Like it's a whole process here.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't care. I pump my own gas. I get looks all the time. I don't care.
That's because it's illegal and rude. That's not New Jersey etiquette, John.
I'm not from here, so I'm allowed.
Yeah, but you have New Jersey plates, so they think you are. So they
That's
think you're
okay.
a big jerk.
I like pumping my own gas. I'm quick and efficient.
So, back to Danya. Danya was faced with a dilemma. Should she just walk down the exit and then walk 3 blocks east and then 3 blocks north and be back at her house? Sleep through the night, and return to her car the following morning? Or should she just take care of it now and fix the situation? It had been ingrained within her to take action and to be self-sufficient, so she chose the latter. She was going to fix the problem. Danya did the correct thing back at her vehicle. Daphne had taught her kids to be strong and not rely on others, so they could change their tires, they knew what to do in case their vehicle broke down, and it was here that she applied that knowledge. She left her emergency blinkers on, rolled up her windows, and locked the vehicle. She started the walk that was just under a mile's distance to the nearest gas station at the time, which was a Texaco. She had with her a small canister in which she could get enough gas to get her home and then back to another gas station the following morning. Two women who were present at the Texaco station that night, Linda Bell and Johnny Mae Harris, recalled seeing Danya walking into the station at around 2 a.m. While she was there, she spoke with the two women and asked them if they could give her a ride back to her vehicle, which was parked just on I-95. Both women wanted to, but were unable to give her a ride because they had come to the gas station without their vehicles. They had walked there as well because they were just going to the convenience store, not getting gas themselves.
Oh, I see. I thought you were saying it just so happens that all three of these women needed gas for their broken down cars. Okay.
Now, meanwhile, just about 5 blocks away, Daphne, who had gone to sleep in her bedroom, had been jolted awake at 2 a.m. She had an awful nightmare, the worst a mother could have. She had dreamed that one of her children was fighting for her life, and she couldn't help her. The dream had been so real and rattled her so badly that she had screamed aloud. Her daughter, Rochelle, ran into her room and asked if she was okay. No, she replied, and asked where Danya was. Her dream had been about Danya, that she had been fighting and screaming for her life, combating some evil force while getting tangled further into sheets. She was so scared for her daughter, and it had seemed so real that she had to check on her 21-year-old daughter to ensure that she was safe before her body would allow her to go back to sleep. So again, she asked if Danya was home yet. Rochelle had been in bed herself, as she had to work the early shift at work, the reason why she wasn't able to go to church with her sister that night. So she said she didn't know. Both women walked to Danya's room, and when Daphne opened the door, she realized that she really had woken up from one nightmare to step right into another, because it was 2 a.m. and her daughter's bed was empty. Daphne and Rochelle called Danya's friend Chloe, as she had been at church with her that night. But Chloe said she didn't know why Danya wasn't home yet. She said she had stayed after a bit to talk to people, but the latest anyone ever stayed after the midnight service was around 1. And if you accounted for the half-hour drive back home, Danya should be there. Chloe confirmed that Danya had told her she was going home. She would never have plans to go out so late by herself, and her family knew that. Everyone in the conversation knew that Danya was too careful to do anything dangerous. They called everyone else they could think of that would have been at the service that night, but they all had the same information to give as Chloe. The whole situation made Daphne sick to her stomach, so she did the only thing she could think of. She went out to look for her daughter. The first place she thought to go was the church. Maybe she had stayed a little bit later, or maybe she had gotten a flat. She knew Danya would know how to change her tire, but she also knew that it would take a while. So she figured she would look for her daughter while she drove around in hopes that she could spot her and help. But she found the parking lot of the church completely empty. She drove around the area of the church and through all the routes that her daughter could have used to get back onto I-95, but she didn't find her. Finally, just before 6 a.m., after driving around for hours, she relented and decided to make her way back home so she could call the police. It was on her way home, just as she put on her blinker because she was approaching the Hillsboro Beach Boulevard exit, that she spotted her daughter's vehicle pulled onto the shoulder with its hazards on. Her heart surged. She thought that maybe Danya was inside. But when she got to the vehicle, she found that all the windows were rolled up, the doors locked. Nothing inside or around the vehicle was in disarray. And the way the vehicle had been left was exactly how Daphne had instructed her children to leave their cars if they ever needed to. Danya wasn't there. So she thought that maybe Danya had walked home. And it was far, but not an unreasonable distance, so maybe that accounted for her time of not being home yet. But after she rushed home, she found that her daughter had not made it home, and that knowing feeling in the pit of her stomach grew larger. If Danya had left her car and was still not home yet, something bad could have happened to her on the way.
Yeah, this is all a lot to take in because, for one, we're not talking about a very like large distance here, like you're talking about. It's it would really suck to have to walk, but it's not out of like
it would be under 2 miles,
right? So I mean, you can do that. It would be very annoying, especially in the dark at 2 a.m.
in your church outfit.
Yeah, but it's doable. There's just so many things because, you know, there's witnesses that see her at the gas station,
right?
And then she obviously made it from the car to the gas station and then back.
Well maybe.
Potentially. But that means that somewhere now on the way back, there was some kind of issue. God, I mean, having this nightmare and then feeling that you need to go into action is incredible and so creepy, but just shows you the power of a mother's love, I guess.
It's true.
But
an intuition.
There is so much to unpack here. I can't wait to like get into this, but I'm confused.
Well, before we get any further into the story, what we're going to do is we're going to take a very short break and give a shout out to a new podcast that we've been obsessed with lately here. It's called Scared All the Time. And it doesn't matter what kind of podcast you're usually into. America's number one fear-based podcast has got it all. True crime, conspiracies, history, science, pop culture, monsters, the paranormal, and more. Scared All the Time is hosted by Ed Vakola, a comedy writer with credits like Rick and Morty and The Last Man on Earth, and Chris Colari, writer and director of the Malin Ackerman thriller, The Aviary, and projects at Blumhouse and Netflix. Each episode, Chris takes a deep dive into the most frightening topics on Earth and terrifies Ed with true stories of all kinds of death, murder, mayhem, and monsters. Together, they've covered everything from spiders to plane crashes to alien abductions to killer clowns, stalkers, elevator disasters, and dozens of other topics. If you've ever wanted to get scared senseless while laughing your ass off, this is the show for you. And don't take our word for it. Scared All the Time is part of the Astonishing Legends Network, so they've got the stamp of approval from some of the best podcasters in the biz. Episodes drop every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts, or head over to patreon.com/scaredallthetime to become a subscriber and get access to bonus episodes, live shows, exclusive merch, and even a Button of the Month Club. Okay, guys, let's get back to the podcast. Daphne couldn't help but remember the awful images from her dream as she called 911 to report Danya missing. After hearing the circumstances of the case, the detective that had been sent out from the Deerfield Beach District of the Broward County Sheriff's Department agreed that things seemed very suspicious. He was aware of the crime statistics in the area, and he had seen a lot during his tenure, so his immediate thought was that this was a homicide. However, that was a fact that he didn't yet share with Danya's family, but he knew sooner or later he would have to prepare them for that difficult conversation.
I mean, I think I find that a little weird, mainly because there's no evidence here at all. First of all, it's 2 a.m. It's a little after 2 a.m. at this point, because I'm sure she called the cops not too long after.
No, she didn't. Remember, she drove around, so she didn't find her car till 6 a.m. So okay. Now it's probably around 7 a.m. So technically, she's been missing. The last time she was seen was 1 a.m.
Okay.
Because they don't know about the women from the gas station yet.
Okay, but still, I'd still find this weird because this all happened at night. She might have been walking to her car. This could be something as simple as she was walking to her car. It was dark and somebody accidentally clipped her or hit her with a vehicle and decided to keep going. Because sometimes a body could travel. It could have went off to the side somewhere. She could be in thick brush and no one just sees her there. She could be there. So to go jump right to homicide just based on statistics in the area, to me, I find to just be a little off-putting. I don't like that. He jumped assertion, to that. You know?
See, I would rather a detective overjump than underjump, because usually we hear and we always complain that they say, oh, they just like went somewhere. I kind of like that this detective is being a little bit more aggressive about this investigation, because it is odd. She's such a rule follower.
Yes, it's out of the norm for sure. But I just think that
homicide too much of it. It could be an accident.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe like pump the brakes a little bit. Let's see what kind of details we could find out.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, the first step of the investigation was to deem the site at which the vehicle had come to a stop as a crime scene, as they didn't know at that point if Danya had been taken from the vehicle or she had left the area. Once they were able to get inside the vehicle, they found some of her belongings were still in the car, mainly her backpack. Something she would never leave behind because of all the study materials she kept inside. It was actually inside the backpack that the detective found what he believed to be the first clue of the case. There was a ripped-out magazine page that displayed an advertisement for engagement rings. The detective believed that this pointed to a romantic interest of some kind. And then, of course, that leads to the assumption that either this person, whoever they were, could have information or might be with Danya. So the detective asked Daphne if she knew who her daughter was in a relationship with. And according to Daphne, the question shocked her. Danya wasn't the type of girl to be preoccupied by things like that. She didn't date. She was really focused on where she was going in life, her ambitions. And on top of that, she was a very religious girl. So dating was kind of not her thing. She also couldn't think of anyone that she could have been romantically involved with. And on top of that, Daphne said that even if her daughter did like somebody or she was in a relationship, that she would have been, or her sister would have been, told about this relationship, and they had not been.
Yeah, once again, that could all be true. But there are times when, you know, you have...
secrets. People have secrets.
People have secrets. I also don't want to, like, jump the gun with this, but, like, I think it's not crazy to say sometimes when you're in a house where there's a lot of structure and you are brought up the right way, but there are pressures to be perfect, mm-hmm. that sometimes those things manifest into having little secrets of some sort. Nothing terrible, nothing bad.
Right.
But just
little innocent things.
You might think you know your child and you might not. That's all I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying.
She's picture perfect to her mother. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the case. Now, I'm sure she's a great woman, you know, but I'm just trying to say, like, you can't sit here and say, I know everything about my child.
Well, I'm going to say something. I'm going to give away something that I never usually give away stuff in the case.
Okay.
Danya is.
Is.
Perfect.
Really?
And is not keeping anything from
her mother. So I am completely wrong with this.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I don't want you to lead down a wrong direction, go down a rabbit hole.
Right. No. But I am making that statement just out loud. Like, sometimes you don't know.
No, I think that's a completely true and valid statement. I just don't want you to go in the wrong direction.
No, I am. My notepad is perfect. Don't worry.
Okay. So once this sentiment that Danya wasn't dating anyone was confirmed by her siblings, the detective moved on from the magazine page and focused instead on trying to trace Danya's last steps. Now, it clearly didn't take a rocket scientist to find out that the reason Danya had pulled her car over to the side of the road was because she had run out of gas. And based on the fact that the canister for gas was missing from her trunk, they also deduced that she most likely went to get gas from one of the nearby stations. The nearest and most convenient station that would have been open at that time was located only a few blocks away from where the car had been pulled over, just before the exit ramp. And that had been the Texaco station. The detectives were able to speak with the clerk that was on duty that night, but he hadn't been able to help because he couldn't specifically remember Danya coming to get gas. She would have had to go up to the register, pay for gas there, something hundreds of people do during his shift. He said all the faces kind of blend together after a while. And this does make sense, because even if the man were to have been trying to pay close attention to his customers for whatever reason that night, we know based on studies that there are low recognition rates in high traffic areas. Now, the detective really did not have luck at this gas station, because while he was talking to the clerk, he also noticed that there were security cameras. So he asked about them. And the clerk unfortunately informed him that those cameras had not worked in months. So no footage had been taken the night Danya had gone missing.
That's unfortunate.
Despite not having proof from the person that had worked there that night or security camera footage, the detective had been able to prove that Danya went to the Texaco station based on the financial records he obtained. Her credit card account showed that she had purchased $2 worth of gas, which would have gotten her a gallon. This was the... Wouldn't that be nice?
Very.
Just under $2. And this was the first real clue they had that confirmed something bad must have happened to Danya. Because if she had actually gotten the gas, but her car was still there and didn't have gas in it, it meant that something had happened to her after the gas purchase.
Yeah, 100%. That's what I'm thinking as she was transitioning from the gas station back to the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Which makes me think now, if we're going to go on that path, are we dealing with, you know, someone following her from the gas station? Because in my head from the beginning, once we knew gas station and church, those are the two places that I was thinking, okay, well, that was the two last places she was seen. So could she have been followed from there? So like that was something I was thinking. You know? Okay.
Well, Daphne and all of Danya's siblings were truly beside themselves with grief. They didn't know what to do, but they desperately wanted to act. They wanted to find her. So they made posters and went on a crusade to ensure that everyone in the Deer Park and surrounding areas saw it, so they could either come forward with something they knew or saw, or that they could get the word out and be on the lookout. Now, usually missing posters don't aid in investigations. Rather, they help raise awareness or attention to a missing person's case. But, miraculously, here they did.
Really?
While together, Linda Bell and Johnny Mae Harris came across the missing posters that stated that Donya DaCosta had last been seen at a Texaco station in the early morning hours of December 5th. And when they saw the picture of Donya, they knew that they had seen the missing woman that night. So without hesitation, they reached out to the police together through the number on the poster to report what they knew. And boy, did it make needing to find Donya even more dire than it had before.
I don't like the sound of this.
The women said that Donya had stuck out to them because not only was she beautiful, but she was dressed in, well, her Sunday best. An odd sight for a late Friday night gas station. She seemed so sweet and innocent. So they remembered being worried about her and telling her to watch out for herself. She had asked them for a ride, which they would have given her, but they didn't have their cars with them. What added instant validity to their statement was the fact that they knew that she had with her a small red container made to transport the gas. According to her family, it was something she always had in her trunk in case of emergencies. So they saw that she went and got gas, and while filling up, Donya was seen by Bell and Harris speaking with a black man who was in a van.
At the gas station?
At the gas station.
Okay.
While she's filling her gas canister. Since there was a lot to learn, and clear validity in the eyewitness testimony, the detectives separated the two women and questioned them about what happened that night, because they didn't want them to influence each other. Johnny Mae Harris said that she remembered the man to be very clean-cut, attractive, and on the younger side. When she saw Donya talking to him, she looked at the man and asked if he was going to help her, referring to Donya, and the man shook his head yes. When asked what the van looked like, Harris said that she thought the van was burgundy in color. But in the end, after being pressed, she seemed very unsure of what the coloring of the car could have been. She did, however, remember that on the side of the van, she remembered seeing the word hope. She also said that it looked like a church van, which had obviously made them all feel safe.
Wow. Okay, this is a lot of info that we're getting from this eyewitness.
In contrast, Linda Bell told detectives the exact same account, except for the fact that she said the van was bluish green color, like a teal. But she also agreed that somewhere on the van, there had appeared the word hope. Now, this is also very ironic because that's actually Donya's middle name.
Oh, wow. Okay. So,
just throwing that out there. Both women had said that the man that helped Donya was distinguished looking and professional. He was charismatic and he put them all at ease. They described him as well-spoken, well-dressed, and handsome. One of the women even said that she specifically remembered thinking, oh, good, he's a nice church guy. And Donya must have thought all the same things and was most likely put at ease because it had seemed that the van was a church vehicle. So she chose to get in as he offered her a ride back to her car.
Yeah. I hate when this happens, because right now this person is using his Good Samaritan mask on and hiding behind church as a cover, which makes me think, like, is this by design? Has something like this happened in before? Mm-hmm. You know, just because I find that that's a million red flags to be that perfect. You know, I mean, I know these people are judging it from a distance, right. But you know, I don't know how that doesn't sound good to me. It's very unsettling.
I think this is also something that Donya was specifically susceptible to.
Right. And I hate to bring this up, but it is something that happens. It's like people that want to do bad, you know, they're going to prey on that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and I'm not saying that she was naive or church makes you weak. That's not
at all what this is.
It's just that.
Well, she's in a vulnerable situation.
She wants to get home. You know, she is looking for help. No one else could help her.
She is very young. She's only 21 years old.
Yeah.
And in her 21 years of existence, those she has encountered surrounding faith in any way have been helpful and supportive to her.
Right.
So that's what she's going to associate this man with.
Right. It's just sad that people use it as a weapon.
It's very sad. Because we've seen that in many cases before.
Essentially, it's a trap.
Yeah.
Having a vehicle like that is a trap for people who believe in the faith.
Yes. Well, you know? And it's almost like when someone picks up another person and there's a woman in the car, so then you feel safer.
Right, exactly. Right. Or a child or, you know, something like that. You know, that's not always the case.
It's true. Well, both women worked with a sketch artist. And once they were happy with the image, it was blasted all over the media and sent to various law enforcement agencies. Because the one thing the women agreed on was the fact that the word hope appeared on the van. Because the one thing that the women agreed on was the fact that the word hope appeared on the van, the detective went through a list of companies that had the word hope in the title of their businesses. And one by one, he checked if any of them had burgundy or teal vans. But he'd come up with nothing. A description of the vehicle was also released with the sketch, so people in the area could be on the lookout for this man and his van. The next clue, the one the detectives had hoped they would never need to find, would reveal itself on the morning of December 7th, 25 miles south of Deer Park in Oakland Park. While someone was working in the row of loading docks connected to a series of warehouses just off of I-95 on 42nd Street, they had found what they believed to be a human body near a dumpster down an alleyway. He called the police and had them come to inspect the area. When the Broward County Sheriff's deputy came out and confirmed that it was a human body, crime scene technicians and detectives were called in immediately. At first, investigators didn't know anything about their victim because they were so heavily wrapped in various items. Two large garbage bags had covered their head, and on top of those garbage bags was a purple duffel bag. Their body was wrapped in a yellow bedsheet, a brown bedsheet, and finally the liner for a shower curtain. Once the medical examiners had been able to get their victim free from the bindings, they found her to be a young Black woman in her early 20s. They surmised that she had been dead between 36 to 72 hours based on their findings. And because all facial features were still recognizable and news had spread throughout the county of a missing woman, they were able to easily identify this woman as Dania DaCosta.
That's so sad.
All of the items that she had been wrapped in were taken in as evidence. There was one sheet of particular interest to the investigators because it appeared that either out of anger or haste to leave the area, that Dania's body had been run over as the presence of tire tracks were on the sheets. Whoever this had been had run her over too.
That's crazy.
When the investigators would learn the harrowing details of what had happened to Dania, that would seem like nothing. The 21-year-old had bite marks all over her arms. She had DNA found beneath her fingernails as she had fought desperately for her life. She had been violently raped, as evident by the bruising in her thigh area and the fact that semen had been found both inside her and on her thighs. She had a horseshoe-shaped abrasion on her forehead. And in fact, based on the injuries to her legs, they surmised that she had been run over by a large vehicle. But there was still more. Dania had been stabbed 36 times in her breast area. by a screwdriver.
Are you kidding me? I mean, this is brutal. Oh, I can't even. I pause because I don't even know how to even put that and quantify that into words. You know,
you can't.
It's disgusting.
This was a brutal murder, and eerily, it had a strange connection to Daphne's dream about her daughter. If you remember, she dreamed that she'd been fighting in sheets.
Yes.
And here her body had been found wrapped in them.
Oh my God.
CODIS, the National Database for DNA Samples of Criminals, was not implemented until 2 months before Danya went missing. It had the workings of being a great tool for law enforcement. They just weren't there yet. When the collected sample taken from Danya's sexual assault kit from her autopsy was tested against the thousands of samples on file, none were found to have matched. Now, today, it would have been a different story. There's over 22.2 million samples within that database. So it was just that the technology wasn't there yet.
I don't know if that's a good thing, that statistic, or a bad thing, the fact that we have that many DNA samples to go off of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the laws have changed over time as to what would get you to have to submit a sample. So
I understand.
It's not just like sexual assaults and things like that. The detectives knew that their best and really only clues came from the eyewitnesses that had seen Danya at the gas station that night. And that meant that everything always went back to this mysterious man in the van. The burgundy or teal van with the word hope on the side of it. There could have been other words, but hope was definitely one of them. So that's what they needed to find. Days after the discovery of Danya's body and the performance of her autopsy, her family held her funeral. People came from all over, even as far as New Jersey, to celebrate the life of Danya DaCosta. Those who did not know her said that they showed up because her spirit and soul were beautiful. She had been a pure, innocent, good girl. And somehow, and for some reason, the devil had gotten to her. Those who knew her attended because of their love that they had for Danya, for what she stood for in their lives, and their sadness at the loss of such a kind and righteous presence. But, as always in the funerals we discuss, the mourners were not the only people in attendance. Among the over 1,500 guests that attended the funeral services were the investigators from the Broward County Sheriff's Department. It would be impossible for them to discern who knew Danya personally and who had not, since so many people had shown up. So they shifted their focus. They wanted to see if anyone acted out, was over-emotional, or said anything strange to any of the victims. In addition to the detectives being present within the service, there were deputies outside looking to see if anyone had driven the van that they were looking for, or if there were any vehicles that were vans or van-like were documented, because at this point, they had already blasted out. They were looking for this van that could be one of these two colors and had the word hope on it. So people could have painted their vehicles. So that's why they were making notes of any van. However, no viable leads came from the funeral that day. The next lead that the detectives would receive came from Daphne herself. She was shocked one day to have looked out her window and saw a van that seemingly matched the description of the vehicle the detectives had been looking for. Although the van did not have the words hope anywhere on it, it was a burgundy church van. The van was parked outside of a neighbor's house, and she called the lead investigator to let them know about the van and gave them the license plate number. Once they caught up with the vehicle that had since left that location, the detectives initially performed a routine traffic stop. Inside the van, they found three young men. The driver's name was Orrin Scott. He admitted that the van was a church van, but it wasn't registered under his name, but under his father's name, who was the pastor of the church. He said that it was technically the church's van, but other people used it from time to time. He said his father had given him permission to drive the vehicle. The detectives asked Scott if he would be willing to let them search the vehicle. He agreed to the search and seizure of the vehicle by saying, "Yeah, I don't have anything to hide." All three young men were brought into the station and questioned about where they were during the early morning hours of December 5th. And they all agreed to DNA swabs to be taken for comparison testing purposes. While the forensic team was searching the van for trace evidence, they found a dress bunched up inside. Besides the dress, no other DNA evidence was found in the van that matched Adonia in any way. The detectives brought the found dress to Daphne and asked her if it had been her daughter's dress. And she said no. That wasn't a dress that she owned, and most definitely wasn't the dress that she had been wearing the night she had gone missing. Weeks later, it would also be revealed that none of the three men's DNA matched the semen sample that had been collected during the sexual assault exam performed during Donya's autopsy. Their DNA also didn't match a hair that had been found on her chest or the skin cell samples that were found beneath her nails. So the detectives continued to work the case for months. As time passed by, they were assigned new cases, which took up some of their time. But they kept in contact with Daphne and the other members of Donya's family and updated them on anything they had. But it was usually just, "We found another van, and it turned out not to be connected." Although the leads were drying up, there was pressure from the higher-ups in the department about the case as well. What had happened to Donya was brutal and terrifying, and their law enforcement experience and training told them that this was not the first time this person had done something similar, or, at the very least, violent, and would most likely do it again. But after following up on hundreds of leads, the sheriff's department had nothing to show for it, and the community was upset. They demanded answers because they were all living in fear. But on March 17th, almost as if by divine intervention, the detectives were assigned a case that brought them to West Broward Boulevard in Lauderhill, right next to the Hope Outreach Ministry Church.
Okay, so have we pinpointed the location of this van?
While they sat in a separate parking lot investigating a totally different case, one of the men was too stunned to even speak. He tapped his partner and pointed to the teal van sitting in the adjacent parking lot. And then the conflicting colors from their eyewitnesses made sense. The van was teal in color, but the words on the side of the van, "Here's Hope," were written in large burgundy letters.
So they both weren't wrong. It was a combination of the two. Yes. Oh my God. Okay.
But can you imagine? She's picked up by a van that says on the side, "Here's Hope." And that's what happened to her.
I don't even want to think about it. That makes me so sick. Yeah. That's something that's supposed to be so good, so pure. Something that we all want to follow, whatever. Like I said, if you believe in all these things,
is manipulated.
It's like, how much more manipulative can you be, right, than that?
You're right. Now, there was a number on the side of the van as well, in a smaller font beneath it. The number was associated with the Generation of Hope Daycare Center, which was a part of the Hope Outreach Ministries. The detectives went into the building and asked about who owned the 1994 Ford van that was parked outside. They were directed to the pastor of the church, Frank Lloyd. Lloyd and his wife, who served as overseer of the church, ran its operations. The detectives asked to speak with Lloyd, and he brought them into his office to talk. This was not the direction they thought they were going in that day. So the detective said they really had to get their bearings and approach the situation with care because Lloyd's role in the situation was unknown. But at the same time, they could be sitting in the same room as their killer, the killer that had eluded them for 3 months. Frank Lloyd admitted that the vehicle was his, but that it was used mainly for the church. He was asked if he ever lent the vehicle out to anyone for use, and he said that sometimes his employees drove it. Next, they asked if he knew who drove or had access to the vehicle on December 4th or 5th. Pastor Lloyd's secretary jumped in as she was present in the room and said that one of their employees had the van that whole weekend, and they'd kind of been upset about it. The pastor explains that he was a very detail-oriented person and meticulous with his record-keeping for his sake and the church's. He turned back 3 months prior in his calendar and looked at the detectives. During those dates, my employee, Lucius Boyd, had the van. They asked him for the details surrounding the vehicle being loaned out, and the pastor explained that it was actually quite odd. Boyd was the handyman at the church, and he asked him to drive him to the airport using the van on December 4th.
Oh, my God. Okay.
He was supposed to have returned the vehicle back to the church parking lot immediately, but instead, he kept the vehicle over the weekend, and he didn't return it until Monday, December 7th.
It's a long time to have that van.
Yes. Now, the reason why it wasn't a bigger deal is because that van is used mainly for transportation for the daycare. So the fact that it wasn't there and it was the weekend, it wasn't too big of a deal, but they were annoyed when he returned it, definitely.
Yeah, I would be too. It's not your property.
Right. So the detectives thanked the pastor for the information and asked that the conversation that they had be kept quiet. And he obviously agreed because they had to do an investigation first. So the detectives then went into a deep dive on Lucius Boyd. And what they found only convinced them further that they had found their guy. Lucius Boyd, who sometimes went by the nickname Lucifer, was 40 years old. He came from a very well-respected family within the Black community of Fort Lauderdale, as they owned the main funeral home in the city, Boyd Funeral Home, which was located on Sis Trunk Boulevard, which is very connected to the Black community. But he didn't seem to fall in line with the rest of his family. Just like his namesake, he seemed to have been the fallen son in so many ways.
I like how you tied that in there, but...
Oh, it's going to be a lot.
I mean, if this is the guy, I mean, I feel like we're there at this point. This might be the guy we're searching for. How scary, though, because I feel like we need to talk about this real quick. How scary that a handyman, which I always feel like it's always the handyman.
It's like it's the Freddy Krueger effect.
Seriously. But that is around children as well as churchgoers.
Mm-hmm.
That is terrifying.
I agree.
But anyway, continue.
I very much agree. First, Boyd had been married and divorced twice. He fathered 8 children by 4 different women. Each of them had sued him for failing to pay child support. Boyd seemed to always have a problem with money, mainly because he had a very expensive cocaine habit. He had for a period of time, I would say he actually kind of always lived back and forth at his parents' house in Plantation, Florida, which is close to Fort Lauderdale. So whenever he would like mess up and couldn't afford to be living on his own or he wasn't living with a girlfriend, he would always return back to his parents' house. But at the time of Donya's murder, he lived in an apartment with his most recent girlfriend, a woman named Geneva Lewis, and her children. This apartment is only 2 blocks away from the Texaco station.
Okay, so he has a very good knowledge of the area that we were talking about from the beginning.
Very much so.
Okay.
One of the reasons Boyd had money problems, aside from the cocaine, was because of his criminal history. He understandably had trouble finding jobs. And once you hear about his criminal history, you'll understand why no one wanted to hire him. First, there was the domestic violence charge. In 1990, Boyd had received a felony charge of aggravated battery for for choking his second wife to the point of unconsciousness when she had threatened to leave him because he had cheated on her.
I mean, that's crazy. Okay, so he's violent.
Very violent. And we know, obviously, domestic violence situations. If this is the phone call, the first charge we are seeing from a legal standpoint, we know that it has happened several times before. We also statistically know that domestic violence victims who suffer from being choked are most likely to die versus others. It's just, it's a sign that they're going to go immediately to that and that it'll most likely lead to death.
So this is like a loaded gun. We have somebody that has past incidents that are violent. We know that he uses drugs, specifically cocaine.
A stimulant.
So mm-hmm. now all these, now the whole case kind of is starting to come to me, like the 36 stab wounds with a screwdriver, the way that he's probably erratic at the crime scene. All this makes sense now.
His anger.
Yes, his anger. There's a lot. Wow.
So that domestic violence charge was later reduced to a misdemeanor and he only had to serve probation.
That's wild.
2 years later, a woman with whom Boyd had gone out on a date with accused him of armed rape. It had been her 18th birthday. No charges were filed against him because she had declined to prosecute. After this, Boyd was accused of rape 3 more times. In those cases, in 2 of them, he was acquitted. And in the other case, to make it 4, that victim, just like the previous one, the first one, chose not to press charges. And 1 year after that, he killed a man.
Killed a man?
Yep.
Let me guess. He claims that he had to do it to protect himself.
Yeah, John, yes.
Yeah, well.
Self-defense.
Oh, there you go. It's that. Oh, God.
In the May 7th, 1994 edition of the Miami Herald, the murder and court case played out in this article. It told the tale of Boyd having been arrested for second-degree murder after he stabbed a man named Roderick Bullard in the streets of Fort Lauderdale outside of his home. His defense attorney, an expensive one from Pompano Beach, most likely paid for by his family, claimed that the murder had been in self-defense. At the time of the murder in 1993, Boyd had been dating the victim's sister for 4 months. Her name was Pat Bullard. Boyd had taken Pat's car to get some work done on it, and she'd become angry when he didn't return the car like he said he would. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, like the van? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Pat and her brother, Roderick, went over to Boyd's house to confront him about this because she needed her vehicle back to get to and from work. And they went to his home in Fort Lauderdale on Northwest 6th Street. And when they got there, they found that he was there with another woman.
Oh, okay.
So an argument ensued in which Boyd threw Pat's car keys into his front yard. Like, basically, like, go get your keys, like, get out of here. And Roderick found this to be disrespectful to his sister. So
yes, because it is.
Yes, it is. So he picked up 2 potted plants and threw them through the picture window of Boyd's home. This caused the 2 men to then get into a physical fight. When Boyd came out and attacked him, he brought a large kitchen knife with him. So this fight ensued outside of the home. So the knife had to have been brought in outside of the house. So the intent was there to bring the knife. Roderick did not have a weapon. But during this fight, 34-year-old Boyd stabbed Roderick with a large kitchen knife, killing him. A jury found him not guilty of second-degree murder.
That's wild.
He had a good...
That is so crazy.
Good defense attorney. Money will get you a good defense attorney. So, Lucius Boyd felt untouchable. So it had really been true, in a literal sense, what people had been saying in a figurative sense. That night, Donya had met the devil.
Yeah. That is so sad, you know? I think what gets me the most, you know, distraught is just the fact that this woman had everything going for her, you know?
Yep.
I know we usually do this towards the end of a case, but I need to, like, just bring it out. You know, she really did everything right. She was raised right. She, you know, she took care of herself. She made sure everything was right.
She had three jobs. She was going to school. She picked a profession where she was going to help people.
It's sad. And that's what makes it that much harder, because this person would have went on to improve the world, improve society.
Yeah.
You know, it's always the ones that you know will make impact that get taken away from us. That's what sucks.
It's really sad.
But anyway, go ahead.
Well, the detectives went back to the Hope Outreach Ministries Center to ask Pastor Lloyd and those within the church some more questions. The detectives laid it all out, everything they had found about Boyd, and they asked him why he would employ a man like that, especially with a daycare center being run out of the church.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the pastor explained that he was a man of God and that he believed in forgiveness. Now, I did some digging. And Hope Ministries is a church that seems to, from what I can see from, like, posters and stuff, pride themselves on giving people second chances. A slogan that they've embraced is, no matter your story, you are received with love. And where everybody is somebody and Christ is all, in reference to their church. So this is why he decided to give Lucius Boyd a job, because he was giving someone a second chance. But someone that's a violent sexual offender like that, that's embedded into them. That's not a mistake.
Well, see, but that's where I have an issue personally. Please no one take offense. This is where it's like where common sense is trumped by faith, when you know for a fact that you should not have that person around anyone.
Especially children.
But I also do believe that people should have second chances and be forgiven, because that's kind of how I was raised as well. So it's this very, you know, this teeter-totter, right, of like what to do, yeah. Right? I just think that, you know, someone's violent, no matter what, they're around children and other people that could potentially be a danger to them, you're not allowed to be there.
Well, I think when it comes to second chances, you also need to take into account the job. Like, are they working in a factory somewhere around other adults, or are they in a position where they're around children all the time, or people that are vulnerable, or maybe coming to that location for help? Like, I feel like that's all very important when it comes to maybe trying to find a job for this person versus just taking them in.
Yeah, because then the other thing, too, is that sometimes when criminals do come out of prison and they want to reform, they want to try to do the right thing and go on a better path, that's also a very hard process, because no one's going to hire a felon. So
it's, you know, very difficult.
Unless it's, you know, especially when it's nonviolent, you know, they have a very hard time. You know what I mean?
I feel bad for those people who are nonviolent offenders.
Well, I do too.
Or maybe in a situation where, you know, they committed an act of violence, like they got into a fight or something like that. But this is totally different.
Totally different, yeah.
He's been accused of rape 4 times, has a domestic violence charge, and murdered somebody.
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, he should not be around anyone.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
So the detectives then inquired if anything was different or odd about the van when Boyd is going to return it. And the pastor said that he noticed that various tools that he kept in the van were missing, specifically a set of Torx brand screwdrivers. What was she stabbed with?
A screwdriver.
And a reciprocating saw.
Oh, my God.
And another item was missing, too. A purple laundry bag that the pastor used to deliver his laundry to the dry cleaners in. The tools were eventually returned on December 15th, but the laundry bag had not been, because it was found over the victim's head.
Oh, my God.
When others were asked about Lucius Boyd and what he was like, they told the detectives that he was very charming, but that he also had a creepy side to him. And his charming wasn't even smooth necessarily. It was kind of sickly sweet. Like, you knew something else was behind it, or he was trying to get something out of him being charming. He always said and did the right thing, but there was just always something off. It made sense. All of this made sense. Donya would have been disarmed by the nice, charming man in the van that read, "Here's hope," because she's in a vulnerable situation, and she would have thought that he was a God-fearing person, as she was, and that he was there to help. But, as revealed by those in his congregation and his past, Lucifer was a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Like, actually the definition of. Like, if there would have been a picture, it would have been him.
Yes.
See, because I don't blame people for trusting like that.
No.
I don't. I know it might have sounded like I do, but I don't. I really don't. He is a monster, every sense of the word, and he abused God.
He did.
He used it as camouflage.
Well, when they also spoke with the pastor, he didn't even realize it, but he had answered a question for them that they had always had about this case. The horseshoe-shaped abrasion on Donya's forehead had not been able to be explained or connected with any weapon. However, based on what had been missing from the van, it made sense. The pressure plate from a reciprocating saw would be consistent with the horse-shaped wound that she had on her forehead. He must have used the heavy tool to knock her out, and that's how he gained control of her before he attacked her.
Oh my God, wait. The guard on it is horseshoe-shaped.
Yes.
Yes. Oh my God.
It was also known that her stab wounds were consistent with the screwdriver, and the fact that the other set of missing tools were screwdrivers made sense. And Lucius Boyd had kept them for so long until December 15th because he'd been cleaning them. The entire van was taken in as evidence and processed at the sheriff's station. And Lucius Boyd was arrested on March 26th, 1999, at his apartment, which was located, again, like I said, only 2 blocks away from the gas station from which Donya was taken. They also had a warrant for his DNA sample, which they took from him. As he was arrested, he said something very interesting to the detectives. He said, "What took you so long?"
Oh, this guy's a little bold, huh?
After the arrest, many, many things came together. First was the DNA evidence. Lucius Boyd's DNA was a match for the hair found on Donya's chest, the skin cells found beneath her nails, and the semen found on and inside her body. Fingerprints had also been taken off of the trash bag that had been wrapped around her head. Prints on the bag matched Boyd's girlfriend and her son, meaning that they weren't involved. The detectives didn't think they were involved at all, but that the bags had been taken from the apartment he was staying in.
Okay.
Boyd's teeth impressions also matched the bite marks found on her arms.
This is so creepy, this guy. Mm-hmm. He really is.
The tires from the van also matched the tire marks found on the sheet Donya was wrapped in. However, it was really hard to kind of connect that to her being run over because there were over 1.5 million tires that could have made those similar impressions, but the DNA evidence was indisputable. He did this. Geneva Lewis, who was his girlfriend at the time, was brought in for questioning, and she was shocked to learn about what her boyfriend had done. Well, she kind of explained that they weren't dating anymore, really, but it was hard to break up with him. Things had not worked out, and he was no longer living in her apartment, but he stayed there often. She said that he was living there, though, full-time during the time of the murder. She claimed that she had been at her mother's house the night of the murder, and she and her children had slept over there, so they had not been home. But when she returned, she remembered getting very angry with Boyd because he had thrown out her whole bed frame and mattress.
What?
And there was no reason to do this because she had just purchased an entire bedroom set that she bought on like store credit and was still paying off. And he just threw it out. and he didn't have a good explanation as to why he did that. And her sheets were missing. And her shower curtain was gone.
Okay.
Like, honey, if your boyfriend does this, call the police.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Call the police.
But you know what? But you have to understand that maybe she just didn't think he was capable of what he actually did. You know what I mean? Like, she's not, that's not on her radar.
No, I know. And another thing is she also has children. This man, I'm going to say, is a little scary. So she probably doesn't want to get him angry. She wants to just, if he's starting to like phase away out of her life, she's going to let him go peacefully into the sunset and not agitate him at all. And 100%. I think that's probably why she didn't call.
Yeah.
So that was all the information they needed to obtain a search warrant for the apartment. The detectives asked Geneva to leave for a few days with her children so they didn't have to be subjected to what they may find. And that was a good idea because they found even more evidence within the residence. Small bloodstains were found on the carpet, but it seemed like the larger area had been cleaned. So they cut the carpet out and peeled it back, and they found larger bloodstains beneath. The blood on the carpet was matched to the blood of Danya. They now knew that he must have incapacitated her with the saw in the van and then carried her inside the apartment where he tortured, raped, and viciously murdered her on the bed, the girl coming home from a church service. And to just add on to the evidence, both women from the gas station that night, Linda Bell and Johnny Mae Harris, both picked Lucius Boyd out of a lineup immediately.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is like an interesting case where the eyewitness testimony was like spot on.
Spot on. Except for the color of the van. Yeah. Which defense attorneys are going to try to argue to discredit them, but I mean, there's no way to discredit them. Lucius Boyd was found guilty of first-degree murder, kidnapping, sexual battery, and for his crimes, he was sentenced to death in June of 2002. But that's not where this story ends. Remember when I told you that investigators had an inkling that their killer had done this before based on the MO that they saw in Danya's case?
Yeah.
Well, they were right.
Okay.
After the arrest of Lucius Boyd, investigators and family members of victims would try to link the murder of their cases or loved ones to the vicious acts of Boyd. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go in time order, not order in which they got tied to him. So first there's Melissa Floyd. Melissa had lived with her mother and two sisters in Fort Lauderdale. All of these cases surround the same area in which the Boyd funeral home is and close to where he is in Plantation in northeast Fort Lauderdale. So this is kind of like his stalking grounds. Her mother, Bertha, had begged Melissa over and over again to stop being involved with drugs. But the addiction had a hold on her. And over time, her addiction to cocaine turned into an addiction to crack. And it had taken over who she was. There was a time when she had gone to rehab for 6 months, and her family got a small glimpse of the wonderful woman that Melissa Floyd once was. But then she slipped back into old habits. By the summer of 1997, she had begun working the streets to support her habit, as the Palm Beach Post had put it. But she never stopped wanting to be with or by her family. Around August 9th, Melissa had spent the day with her family and then left, meaning she would be so near where the funeral home was. She usually called someone in her family weekly, but the phone calls stopped. So they split up and scoured the streets for her. However, they'd come up empty. Melissa at that point had transitioned to living on the streets full time, and they thought that maybe she wanted to keep her distance or that she had moved. So when they hadn't heard from her by November, so already we're talking about August to November, that's when they report her missing. Because it's hard when you're dealing with someone who has a problem with addiction and is living on the streets. The only thing of Melissa's that ever turned up when her family looked for her had been found outside of Boyd's funeral home.
Get out of here.
Her wallet.
Okay, how would that get there?
One of the family members, so one of Lucius Boyd's family members found her wallet and called the police to return it. And that's how her family found it was there.
That's crazy.
But they're not making this connection. This is 1997. But then the Floyd family got the news they dreaded. The sad fate they were horrified that Melissa would meet happened. She had been murdered. Her body was found in an area of high grass just off of I-95, just north of Donald Ross Road in Palm Beach County. She had been stabbed to death. It had taken 4 months to identify her body because she had no identification on her, and she'd been left in another county, and her parents reported her missing in November. And when she had been reported missing, she'd been reported missing in Broward County, but her body had been found in Jupiter, which is in Palm Beach County. She was identified using a single smudged fingerprint and a tattoo that she had on her arm. Because of her lifestyle and lack of evidence, her case fell somewhere at the bottom of a very, very large pile of people whose murders don't get investigated as readily. The reality is where Melissa was at her family's house that day, the day that she was last seen, was less than a mile away from the Boyd funeral home, outside of which her wallet was found. So had Lucius Boyd picked her up? It was a possibility. But as of 2026, we have no further evidence to prove that there's a connection. Then it had also been told to the family members of 20-year-old Gina Marie Moore that Lucius Boyd was a suspect that they were considering in her death. There's some indication that the sister of Gina Marie had told media that Boyd's DNA had been found on her sister, but I couldn't find any verification of that. Gina Marie Moore was found on February 16, 1998, near a canal along Beeline Highway in Palm Beach County. She was nude, and her cause of death may have been asphyxiation because they couldn't find another cause of death. But she, like Melissa Floyd, was working in the sex industry. So again, those cases really kind of are put low on the totem pole. So they're not really looked into too much.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Then there was 19-year-old Patrice Alston. On June 28, 1998, she had been seen getting into a green Mazda with Lucius Boyd. It was said that the two were headed to Winter Haven in Polk County, 200 miles away, for a trip together. And they were supposed to stay for a few days, but the following day, Boyd returned without Patrice. Her family reported her missing when they received no answers from Lucius Boyd about where she was. When questioned by police, he said that he returned with Patrice and gave them a list of witnesses that had seen them return together. However, when police spoke with these witnesses, they denied having seen Boyd with Patrice. And later, Boyd changed his story and said that while they were in Winter Haven, Patrice went off with two other men, so he just left.
Okay.
Patrice's body has never been found. And law enforcement believe that Lucius Boyd was responsible for her disappearance and potentially her murder, but they have nothing to pin it on him with. Now, Patrice's father is a Broward County Sheriff's officer. And I believe that if Boyd had committed this crime, which all signs, in my opinion, kind of point to yes, I think it emboldened him even more. I'm going to take one of your daughters. It's a slap in the face, not just to the people of Broward County, but law enforcement as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is, I feel like he's got this, I guess you like this bravado, I guess, like I'm untouchable, like you said earlier, because of him getting out of the murder charge.
Getting away with everything.
You know, so I totally can see that being a thing.
Finally, police believe that Boyd is connected to the murder of Danielle Zico. The 25-year-old graphic designer lived with her boyfriend in Northeast Fort Lauderdale. She had made a late-night run to the local Winn-Dixie to purchase some items around 1 a.m., but she never returned. An employee at the grocery store said that she had seen Danielle at the store and that she purchased a loaf of bread. Her vehicle was found in the Winn-Dixie parking lot. This is very similar to Danya's case.
Yes.
But she was nowhere to be found, and she was never heard from again. Police have never found her body, and they believe that Lucius Boyd is responsible. Danielle's father appealed to Florida governor at the time, Jeb Bush, and asked him to commute Boyd's sentence to life in prison. His fear was that if Boyd died, he would never know what happened to Danielle. He was 66 at the time, and he claimed that the only thing keeping him alive was finding out where she was and giving her a proper burial. Sergeant Barry Alston, the father of Patrice, reiterated the sentiment. He wanted Boyd to die for what he did, but he wanted to know where his daughter was more. When asked about this, Daphne said, the mother of Danya, "I feel empathy for the families, but I want to see Lucius die for what he did to my daughter. If he lives, he could carve out a comfortable niche in prison, lifting weights, playing basketball, getting 3 meals a day. I'd rather know that he's going to get the death penalty. But," she said, "I hate to see the parents suffer. For 3 days, we didn't find Danya, and that was a living hell. Not knowing if she's dead or alive, if she's suffering. We're grateful that we found her and were able to give her a decent burial and get Lucius Boyd off the streets." So, she added, that she would concede for the families. If Boyd was willing to talk in exchange for getting the death penalty off the table, she said, "I guess I would go for that. If it meant giving peace to the other families."
Yeah.
But he has never admitted to anything. But after 2 decades, there was finally a case that stuck.
Okay.
But surprisingly, it's not one of the cases I just mentioned.
Oh, I mean, this guy, if he is responsible, he's a serial killer, hands down.
Yes. In 2023, the Broward County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit had been able to identify a woman who had been known only as Jane Doe for 25 years. Her name is Eileen Troupner. Eileen was a 41-year-old Puerto Rican immigrant and mother of two. She had only moved to America a few years prior, just as Daphne had, in hopes of a better life for herself and her children. On December 18th, just 13 days after he murdered Danya, he raped and strangled her to death.
That's crazy. This guy was on a warpath.
Now, this is interesting because now we know for a fact that he did kill her. So his MO is not just stabbing, it's also asphyxiation, which he is connected with other victims for.
Yeah.
Her body had been found just 2 weeks after the murder of Danya DaCosta in a grassy area just off of US 27 where it meets Interstate 75. DNA from her killer had been found during a sexual assault kit that had been performed during her autopsy. Her identity had never been known because she had no papers on her at the time, and her appearance didn't match any reported missing persons in the area. Her identity was uncovered through the unit's cooperation with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's Genetic Genealogy Unit, and so had her killers. Once the DNA sample was finally run through CODIS, it was connected to Lucius Boyd. So just 2 weeks after Danya's murder, he raped and killed another woman.
This guy's nuts.
In November of 2023, Boyd was charged with first-degree murder and sexual battery charges. He pled not guilty. Sheriff Gregory Tony from Broward County had this message for the public. If you commit a crime, a brutal murder or rape, whether it was now or 20 years ago or tomorrow, we will find you.
I like that.
I like that
too. I really do.
Eileen's family, although grateful for the truth finally being revealed, were hurt all over again to have to relive her disappearance and the pain that came with knowing what had happened to her. So I just want to lay out the timeline here and include all of the murders that Boyd was potentially involved in as well. So in August of 1997, we have Melissa Floyd. 6 months later, in February of 1998, Gina Marie Moore. Then just 4 months later, in June of 1998, Patrice Alston. Then just 6 months later, Donya DaCosta. And then 2 weeks later, Eileen Trumpner. Now, if this is true, it would have made more sense, the comment that Lucius Boyd made to the detectives. What took you so long? Because he had done this.
Yeah. He was just on a rampage. He was going at one after the other after the other.
Now, there may be other people that should be on that list, but that's all we know or have been associated with him for now. But if Melissa Floyd and Gina Marie Moore are his first few victims, it would make sense, right? Because he's choosing really vulnerable women that he knew most likely, because he's around the surrounding area, were working as sex workers, right? So they're vulnerable. They're addicted to drugs. They live close. He might even know them because of his habit himself. And he knows that the investigation into them will not be intense. They were easy targets for him. And they always say this with serial killers, that they practice on more vulnerable victims first. Then he got bolder and bolder as he moved along. And his time frame shortened. He was escalating and growing more confident and bolder. And he just kept getting away with it. The rapes, the murders, especially the kidnapping and murder of a sheriff sergeant. I mean, he was a charmer and he came off as helpful. He was very good at convincing and making people believe. The pastor of Hope Ministries had even told Boyd that he'd be a good minister himself. He used his gifts for evil, though. And many women in Broward County fell for the charms of the devil himself. But it's the women that I want to end the podcast with, not their killer. Melissa Floyd, Gina Marie Moore, Patrice Alston, Donya DaCosta, Eileen Trupner, Roderick Bullard, the women that were sexually assaulted by him and too scared to press charges, and the women that did and never saw him punished for what he did to them, and the other victims we've yet to learn about.
It's really sad. I mean, but I'm glad, though, that we can at least talk about that here and all the victims of this maniac.
Right.
But, God.
That's so sad.
It is.
And the way it unfolded after it was just like, okay, it's obviously him. And then to see all these cases just kind of fall on top of this investigation, it's terrifying to know that they had someone out there like this. And I mean, Florida isn't necessarily immune to it. You know, they had the Gainesville Ripper who acted within only a few days' time. I mean, he did commit that one murder the like year before, but this is very similar to that, like right away, all at once, this serial killer is just acting. It's terrifying. And I mean, months to weeks.
You could make the argument that he was doing this and he wasn't hiding. Not really.
No, he wasn't. But listen, he was choosing his victims, most of them, not all of them that are his accused victims, from the black community. And some of them were sex workers.
Right.
So, I mean, yes, he's kind of not doing too much to hide himself, but I think he was just so confident in getting away with it and non-investigating. And then he goes and it's a sergeant in the sheriff's department.
It just shows you that he just wasn't scared at all.
No, and he just returned without her.
Yeah.
Wild.
That's crazy.
And then he said, what took you so long?
Yeah.
Ugh, what a loser.
so brazen, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can't wait to hear what you have to say about this case. But before we go, we want to say thank you to our newest supporters on Patreon. So thank you so much to Caitlin Cunningham, Nicole Shenandoah, Ruth Perkins, Keegan Blakely, Daisy Ruiz, Tom East, Craig Holden, Naomi Sims, Mel Lacava, Maria Delgado, Angela Harris, Stephanie Kirkpatrick, Shavante Anderson, Alicia Scanlon, Autumn Courteau, Devorian Krause, Ashley J, Michelle Dingle, Sophie, Amanda Cahill, Margaret Coymans, Lucia Krause, and Amalia. Thank you guys so much for joining Patreon. We hope you're enjoying the episodes. Please, if I pronounce your name wrong, you just let me know and I will say it again in 2 weeks. But until next time, guys, and boy, do we mean it. Don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.